Welcome to another episode of This Week in Wealth. It's a bumper episode this week with a stellar lineup of not one, not two, but three guests. So by way of introduction, I am Alex Steger, and I'm joined by Ian Wenick, Andrew Forsch, and Sam Bojarski. Guys, great to be here. Thank you all very much for joining me.
It's great to be here. Unfortunately, not as much of the same natural banter because Sam and I are currently using the buddy system on a mic.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if we needed to share the operational difficulties with our audience, given the audio format of this.
It's a visual podcast.
It's a visual, but it's not yet. Anyway, yes, Sam and Ian are sharing a mic. Andrew's dialing in from DC. But they're all here because we've got a lot to talk about. So let's get straight into it. And Ian, I think we're going to open with what I would call a Wenig classic. So the story, very briefly, I'll tee you up and then you can get into it, is that Focus Financial Partners, the you call it an RIA financier, don't we, often? But really it's the, if not the first, one of the first sort of large RIA aggregators, kind of definitely one of the earliest of these PE-backed big RIA buyers. Anyway, they're looking to sell a minority stake. So explain the story and then we'll get into why this matters so much.
Yes. So, you know, I think it's fitting that we drop this story the day of the All-Star Game. It's the Midsummer Classic, and it's also, as discussed previously on the show, the Summer of Scoops, and this has been one of the best ones
so
far.
Yeah, as discussed previously, you've said that phrase, and now you're trying to make it a thing, but I respect it.
Well, you know, I'm delivering on my promise. Anyway, so, main story, Clayton DeBilly and Rice, they've owned Focus, which has well north of $500 billion in combined assets. They backed them since 2023, and the plan now is that they are pursuing a sale of a minority stake in the company. So that's key. They're going to keep control. They're not exiting. And they've hired Goldman Sachs to serve as their financial advisor as they seek a new investor. Who that new investor is? You know, we're a long way from getting there. This is just getting underway. I'd expect this to be a process that takes several months. But if you told me another private equity sponsor comes in, I would not be shocked.
Okay, and so just to take a very quick step back, they've owned it since 2023 when they took it private.
Yes.
It had previously been a public company.
Yes.
Since 2018.
Yes.
So it was only on the public markets for about 5 years.
That's correct.
And it had been taken public, having previously been backed by KKR and
Stone Point. Which is still an investor.
But a smaller. So they kept some on the table post the CD&R deal. Okay. So they will remain an investor, we believe?
Yes.
After this deal?
What I was told by my source with knowledge of the situation was that the expectation is that nobody is totally exiting their position in the company.
Okay. And I guess the question then being, why now? So CD&R has, as you said, since 2023, we're in 2026. So we're only sort of 2-3 years into that, the life cycle of that deal. Typically, those deals are what, sort of five years plus, and we know how attractive these RIA businesses are. We are seeing a lot of PE firms hold on to the positions for longer. They say, at least publicly, that that's a deliberate choice, and they're doing that because they like the businesses rather than because they can't find an exit. So why are CD&R looking for an exit or looking to do this deal at all?
Well, I think the first thing to recognize is that when CD&R acquired folks and took it private, it was very obvious to any serious observer of the RIA M&A market that Focus was a seriously undervalued company. And that's because since Focus was a public company, it was trading at a multiple lower than a lot of the private company transactions that we've seen. So when CD&R took Focus private in 2023, they bought it at effectively a 13 times earnings multiple. That's a massive discount when you think about the 23, 24, 25 times earnings multiples we've seen companies like Creative Planning and Cerity Partners
get. Are the mega RIA.
Exactly.
Sort of peer-to-peer comparison.
And part of the reason that Focus was discounted was, one, not only because it was publicly traded, but because Focus has historically been this network of a disparate group of 70-plus RIAs and RIA-adjacent businesses. And so what CD&R and Stone Point very smartly did was they used the take private deal and the time that that gave them to pursue this path of internal consolidation, which not only would boost valuations and improve synergies, using some corporate speak, ultimately, that'd be massive for the valuation on the back end. And so this is, for them, a partial monetization, but it's worth noting that, one, they've already taken about $1.5 billion in distributions to their investors through two dividend recaps. We'll get into that. And the second is that they're going to make a ton of money on this company one way or another from the change in strategy.
Okay, so just very, very quickly, before we even get into the dividend recap, why do public markets not value these kind of businesses in the same way that private markets do?
So that is a very good question. I think, you know, the sense that I've gotten from talking to some other industry experts is that there's no really great public comp for an RIA. There is LPL Financial, and we'll do a little bit of foreshadowing. But some people think that LPL's multiple in the 20s is based more on kind of their cash sweep economics. Put a bookmark in that. A lot of times, RIAs have traded at multiples similar to asset managers. And the idea is that, you know, they're both companies that have very strongly market-linked revenues. But I think what people don't realize and why the valuation discount doesn't really make a lot of sense is because, while a lot of publicly traded asset managers are in secular decline and on net negative flows, RIA assets are tremendously sticky. And so, yes, they're both market-linked, but the cash flows are much more stable, and you're not dealing with this secular shift from active to passive that has beguiled so many of these public asset managers.
Yeah, so basically much stickier assets, but they're not getting rewarded for that. And then I don't
higher margin.
Higher margin. And I guess there's also the debt element is in there, which public markets maybe punish them more for the leverage than private markets. They're a bit more comfortable with that.
And I think that's kind of, it's kind of funny because, so if I'm off by a half turn or two, please don't kill me, listeners, because I'm going this off the dome. But when Focus was a public company, it was getting hammered by analysts for trading in the 4 to 4.5 times net leverage ratio multiple. And for listeners who don't know what that is, that's basically the ratio of a company's total debt to its earnings. Focus, since it's been taken private and gone through multiple dividend recaps, I believe that number now is closer to 6. So it's operating very comfortably, despite being two full turns higher leverage than it was getting killed for when it was a public company.
Okay, I've got two more questions on this before we move on. First up, dividend recaps you mentioned. So they have already effectively taken out $1.5 billion, give or take,
billion
across those two. For listeners less familiar with that, can you give us a very quick WikiWenick breakdown of those dividend recaps?
Yes, so very good question. A dividend recap is basically used by a private equity firm to fund distributions to its investors without actually selling the underlying equity of the portfolio company, which is the most valuable thing that it possesses. And so the idea is that it puts debt on the company's balance sheet to fund a dividend, similar to what you get when you own a dividend-paying public share.
Yes, so the underlying company borrows a ton of money, and that money is paid out to investors in the fund that owns said company. And so they've done that twice.
They've done that twice for a combined total of $1.5 billion. Once earlier this year, and I believe once in 2025.
Okay. And then to sort of put a bow on this, your sense is they got this, taking it private at a relative discount. So there's already a sort of arbitrage opportunity there because they got it cheap. They've also made all these changes, as we've discussed just now, but also many times before on the podcast, in terms of centralizing this, making it a more homogenous business, and therefore potentially boosting its value too. And they think that there's an opportunity to, you know, again, even just within these 3 years, make a decent profit on what they paid for the percentage that they're going to sell.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you told me, I'd be curious to know what the actual number is when it's said and done. But I would expect Focus to have an enterprise value well north of $10 billion as the mark on this transaction. I'd be shocked with anything less than $10 billion.
And it went private at seven and a half. Okay, all right. Excellent. Well, there's a prediction that we will try and hold you to, Ian. Thank you very much for that. Now, Andrew joined us from DC, and we've got a completely different story to talk about now. Also involves one of the big, large sort of RIA consolidators, though. In this case, Corient. This is something I should know. Is Corient just Corient, like sort of Prince or Seal, or is it Corient Investment Advisors? Does it have?
I think they might have used to. In the past, they were Corient Private Wealth, but we've taken to just referring to them as
just
Corient.
Just a single name, yeah. Fair play. Okay, and this is not an M&A story at all. This is a sort of in the weeds, something they put in their form ADV, a place that we like to look a lot. I'm not going to tee it up more than that. Tell us what the story is.
Yeah, it's a weird one. So Corient, listener, if you're unaware, one of the biggest RIAs in the country. It's the kind of U.S. wealth management arm of CI Financial, a publicly traded Canadian asset manager. Corient's also one of the most prolific acquirers of wealth managers in the country. And yeah, as Alex says, this is not an M&A story. It is kind of a weird one. I was doing a little bit. I was just sitting around on a Sunday, and I noticed that they had updated their Form ADV brochure.
Listener, if you had any doubt about our dedication to covering this space, I hope that has put it to one side.
And so I'm poking around, just kind of nosing through the part two there, and saw something that was interesting, which was the addition of some language into the Form ADV, which is the kind of main disclosure document that RIAs, registered RIAs, have to file with the SEC, disclosing that there was a conflict of interest that would result from a pay policy in which Corient would incentivize its advisors to place client assets in alternative investment vehicles. And so that, of course, is a fascinating story. And so we did a little bit of reporting, wrote up a story, spoke to some folks about it, and eventually went to Corient. What happened was pretty strange. Corient responds by vehemently denying that they are doing this, that they are incentivizing advisors to place assets in alts. And basically the whole thing was explained away as an error made by Corient's compliance department in filing this ADV. And so that obviously shot down the prospects of kind of a hard news story reporting that the company is doing this. But the very fact that the ADV was updated to disclose this conflict in a bunch of different spots with very specific language, and then the company denied that it was doing this and kind of writing it off as an error, was fascinating. And so we wrote up a story based on that anyway. And they did quickly change their ADV, I believe the very same day that I had reached out and started talking with them about this. They amended their ADV to specify that Corient does not do this.
Yeah. So the story,
which is interesting in itself for a number of reasons. So I'll pause there for follow-ups.
Effectively, the story became not they've disclosed that they're doing this, but actually the story effectively then became they made a mistake in their ADV. Here's what it did say, but that was an error. It itself a strange thing to have happened. And here's what it says now. And then they obviously then also followed up with some statements to us being sort of very, what's the sort of phrase I'm looking for here? Very, very certain, very strident in the fact that this was, that there was nothing to see here, that this was just a mistake and things have been fixed. So I suppose the language that they used before stated that certain aspects of each wealth advisor's overall compensation are contingent in part on reaching certain thresholds tied to the percentage of the wealth advisor's clients' assets that are invested in affiliated and unaffiliated alternative investment vehicles, and goes on to say, as a result, advisors have an incentive to recommend clients invest in these products. And then they clarify that to effectively say that's not the case and that no element of advisors' compensation is tied to investing in alts in that way.
The new language, and I was trying to avoid just reading off disclosure language because I don't know how well that'll translate over.
You don't think that's audio, top quality podcasting? But, I don't know.
Yeah. But I do think, I mean, in this case, the specifics are important. So I'll read off. This was one of the disclosures added into the amended ADV that came after. Wealth advisors do not receive and are not eligible to receive any incremental compensation based solely on investing wealth management clients in private funds. Yeah, I mean, that's pretty clear. Incremental compensation, I guess I have kind of some fleeting questions around what exactly that is and what that means and how that might differ from incentive compensation. Frankly, I don't exactly know. So maybe some further reporting to do there. But the whole saga just seemed fascinating. And the fact that this language was, you know, as Corient says, erroneously added in all these different places in the ADV. I mean, the language was clear and specific. And of course, the correction is also clear and specific. So I don't know. It's just a strange tale. I mean, this is a half a trillion dollar RIA with a large compliance department, and the error itself is interesting. But I do think, you know, the story kind of brings up, it surfaces these broader questions that people are starting to have around the relationship between a fiduciary wealth manager and this kind of rising tide of demand for alternative investment access among RIA clients, and kind of the conflicts that crop up. And we've done other reporting on this. Not, I mean, obviously, Corient is saying it is not doing this, so I want to be fair to the company and careful to kind of caveat that. But Sam, maybe to call you in here, like, you've done some really wonderful reporting and writing on this subject. I mean, we've seen at large RIAs where maybe there are incentives, or maybe there are conflicts of interest that crop up when RIAs begin to offer alternative investment vehicles to their clients. Is that something you're, I'm sorry to put you on the spot there if you're not prepared to talk about that.
No, all good. Yeah, no, that's it. Yeah, it's definitely interesting. And of course, like, as more and more like PE money pours into RIAs, that's also created conflicts too. We did some reporting on a firm called Sanctuary. Once their backers invested back in 2022, there was sort of this push, sources told us, to put clients' money into their backers' funds. And
That was Kennedy Lewis back then, wasn't it? Was it a specific BDC, I think, which they then had launched? And
the BDC called Kennedy Lewis Capital Company, yeah.
Yeah, in relatively short order, they said, well, hang on, lads, financial advisors, why don't you have a look at that?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, Sanctuary is by no means unique in doing this, or at least by no means unique in
having that dynamic at play,
putting their backers' funds on their platform basically for clients. Firms like Beacon Point have disclosed that they do the same. That's one of the main conflicts of interest that's been.
I suppose we should caveat that, just to keep everybody happy, to keep everyone's lawyers, compliance, and PR people at bay. Beacon Point, we never had a story there saying they were pushing their backers' funds. Their backers are, again,
KKR.
I thought so. Just want to make sure. We never had a story saying they're particularly pushing those. It's more just you have to disclose that, yes, we are owned by that firm, and we may, in the course of our business, offer funds that are also run by that firm. And that in and of itself...
And that might be...
Yeah, exactly. That's not inherently bad.
Product. It might be cheaper than competitors. It might have better performance than competitors. That's okay. Inherently, it is okay. But inherently, there also is technically a conflict which must be reported.
Yeah. And again, just on the Corient thing, they, in their instance, I think they mentioned they have two affiliated funds. I think we've also written separately about one of those funds. And again, that's not uncommon. A lot of RIAs, as I think our colleague Tanya Mitchell has reported, a lot of RIAs are increasingly building their own private market vehicles. Mostly they're sort of fund of funds. And then that looks sort of terrible, because you're like, oh, you're funneling clients into your own funds. I think a more sort of generous and probably more accurate interpretation of that is it's more done for operational reasons. It's actually a way of giving them one thing to allocate to rather than sort of 10. And then there are also actual cost benefits to the clients of doing it. So not everything is bad. We shouldn't necessarily always sort of lean to the cynical, but obviously the whole dynamic, and Sam, to your point, the dynamic of more and more RIAs, as we just discussed on Ian's story, being owned by sometimes not one, not two, but even three different PE backers, means that there is a high chance you then may be recommending funds also owned or run by one of your backers. Excellent. Look, we could talk about that all day. And we could read disclosure documents all day, and both things would be interesting. But we've got one more story to cover in this episode, and I'm keen to get to it. So, Sam, let's bring you in on our final item for the day, which is a little bit of a blast from the past. We're going to talk about Betterment and a lawsuit involving how they treat client cash and sort of keeping the spread on that, which is something that I feel like we talked about a lot more in... I don't even know what year now.
2024. 2024 is when it came to the fore. Yeah.
But before we get into that, so give us a skinny on the story.
Yeah, so Betterment is just the latest firm that has that's facing a lawsuit over its cash sweep practices. And there was a client who filed a class action last week, claiming that they were paid no interest from their cash sweep program.
Meanwhile, Betterment was enjoying much better rates on said cash and keeping the difference effectively.
Right. Yeah, they were working with program banks and basically pocketing all the net interest revenue.
Yeah. Okay. And this was a big story. I mean, obviously rates have been up since 22. This was a big story in, you mentioned 24, because we saw more of these lawsuits against some other high profile firms. LPL, I think, springs to my mind. Not picking on them, it's just the one I remember, where some suits were bought. And there were also stories that we and others wrote about the SEC looking at various companies around this issue.
Yes. So, I mean, basically, a lot of this stuff dates back to 2024. The main thing that really caused it, I recall, was there was actually a research note how Schwab was considering changes to its own cash sweep program, and it caused LPL shares to drop like crazy. And then in the wake of that, there were several suits.
The idea being that that Schwab would keep less of the margin.
Yes.
And the analyst note effectively saying, well, if Schwab keeps less of the margin, that means other people who are more dependent on that margin will also have to keep less of it. And that will impact their revenues and therefore impact their
share
price.
It will destroy their margins for a lot of these independent broker dealers. And so LPL was hit with several lawsuits that sought class action status, and there were several SEC investigations. Ultimately, Wells Fargo and Merrill Lynch were fined a combined $60 million by the SEC over their cash sweep practices. But a lot of those class action suits didn't really get anywhere. And then we also saw in February, the SEC actually dropped its probe into LPL's cash sweep practices without any action.
We should also note that the SEC, Sam, as we've talked about before in this podcast and you've written about a lot, has changed in that time. So the SEC of, wait, let me get this right. Well, the SEC of the start of 24 is different from the SEC today, if I got...
It was run by Gary Gensler then.
Much more officious, much more...
Under President Biden, a little bit more active when it comes to enforcement.
Okay, so very quickly to wrap up though, Sam, where next for this Betterment suit? Obviously, Ian's alluded to the fact that some of the LPL ones didn't get anywhere, but what should we watch out for next in this one?
Well, it's interesting that that clients are claiming they were paid zero interest. Even in the past ones, firms like LPL and like Merrill that were sued, at least paid some interest to clients. But
it could be a different case. Yeah, we can't necessarily say one's a precedent for the other.
Yeah, yeah, that's unique, and they're saying that that was like an inherently disloyal arrangement.
Inherently disloyal. Good phrase.
Against fiduciary duty.
Sam, correct me if I'm wrong, but I do think as well the cash sweep program in question is no longer being operated. Betterment has since kind of reorganized its cash sweep programs. They've consolidated everything into one product, and I think the program that this customer has complained about, I believe, is no longer being operated.
Yeah, yeah, that is true. They made some changes a couple months ago. Clients now do have the option to enroll in a program, I believe, that pays them some interest. Yeah.
Interesting. Okay, well, we will watch out for that suit. Did Betterment say anything to you about it at all? Did they acknowledge? They did not address it. Okay.
No, one reached out.
Well, we'll look out to see if they say anything further or indeed if their lawyers do in this case, and we will report on that. And we haven't mentioned it so far in this podcast, and we normally do. So for all these stories, keep your eyes on Ian.
Citywire.com/RIA.
That's right. The best URL around. Excellent. Well, look, we're up on time, guys. Normally, I would indulge, I say us, but I mean myself, and talk about the World Cup. But by the time this comes out, England will either be in the final or not. So, my emotional state will be different from whatever it is today. So I think we'll leave it there. Thank you all very much for joining.
Yes. Got to make a quick note. Today is my daughter's first birthday.
Oh, wow.
So we want to make a quick shout out, say happy birthday, Penelope, if you are ever listening to this, years and years, decades in the future, I apologize and thank you very much.
And if you are listening to it, I hope you enjoyed the bit where we read out disclosure documents
exactly.
As a 12 or 13-year-old child of the future. I'm sure that was joyous for you. Shout out, Penelope. Happy birthday. And on that lovely note, we will leave it there. But listener, thank you as ever for tuning in. And we'll be back again very soon for another episode of This Week in Wealth.